Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time for our annual draft recap. I know this is a show I look forward to doing every year. The draft is a culmination of a lot of work, and then it's a lot of fun to watch the draft together, to consterne over every selection. We certainly had lots of reason to do that this year. Anyway, joining me to talk about that experience is Jake Vogel. Jake, how you doing?
Doing great, Ken. How about you?
I'm doing okay. I think it was a plus draft for the Ravens, not three pluses, but a plus draft. And I'm most feeling boxed in after this draft about the Ravens' solution to their left tackle issues really not being handled.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I know that there are certain people, of course, including the player, as we get into the second round, Roger Rosengarten, that would, you know, provide some optimism towards a left tackle of the future potential. But you know, I think right now, just like you, that he's probably penciled in as the right tackle. And I don't know if he's really going to be a left tackle option for them. So that is definitely the frustration along the offensive line, and maybe a little bit of a lack of picks there.
Yeah. I mean, a lack of total draft capital, you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't have much of an option in terms of moving up. They did have, I guess, 9 picks. So that was kind of exciting. And day 3 was a lot of fun in terms of seeing some guys. Day 3 it's a whirlwind for me because it's a lot of players that I don't know anything about yet. You know, seeing some players who are drafted, including the last couple of guys the Ravens drafted, and not knowing anything about them, you know, going in is kind of interesting. So I've done a little bit of research since, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about everybody as we go through this. But let's talk about the rollout of the draft early, because I think one of the interesting things that started off was the run on quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It was a huge benefit to Baltimore as well as our primary competitors in the AFC. So, you know, an overall positive that 6 quarterbacks came off in the first round early. But definitely a surprise. I think the biggest surprise was Atlanta going with Michael Penix. That kind of came out of nowhere, especially with them having just inked Kirk Cousins to that $100 million plus contract.
Right. So it's the Cousins deal is really like a 2-year deal where they can get out of about, I think it's something like $65 million of that 100. It's maybe not quite that much, but there's a substantial amount they can save if they cut him in 26, but he's really going to be there through 25. So we don't have to go through this. We talked about that on the show. It's worth listening to in terms of the draft, the first round of the draft when you look at it. And it was certainly an interesting pick, but not one that I think was really shocking. And then the 12th pick with Knicks going to the Broncos. I think the Broncos were kind of feeling some of those trash compactor walls closing in on them too, in terms of maybe not getting a quarterback, because it was a long, long fall off the cliff to Spencer Rattler at the 7th quarterback taken.
Absolutely agree with that. It is rare to see that many quarterbacks come off the board in the first round. I think it's only happened a couple times, and I don't know if it's ever happened that early. With all six being through the 12th pick.
Yeah, that, I think that was a record. I think they said so on air, but if I'm wrong, I apologize for that. The Jets ended up trading the number 10 pick.
And they just moved one spot, correct?
One spot with the Vikings, right? So the Vikings moved up, and the Jets were linked very closely to Brock Bowers. It was a spot at which I thought there would be a chance where the Vikings might take a player. But Ravens had some bad news. I'm sorry, I've got to step back for a second. The Ravens had some bad news at number five when the Chargers took Joe Alt, which precipitated a run on left tackles. So that's the second run that got precipitated in this draft. The Jets traded out of number 10. The Vikings went up and they picked J.J. McCarthy at number 10. And then at number 11, instead of Bowers, which would have been perfectly fine, you know, we expected him to go before and he ended up going, but a little bit later, they ended up taking Fashanu at number 11. That kind of put the Ravens in a two left tackle hole at that moment, meaning there were two less tackles than we could have reasonably expected to be on the board.
Yeah, completely agree with that. It definitely came to it was probably a pretty big surprise that the Chargers went with an offensive tackle. But when you look at the team, and the change that they've had in general manager, head coach, and possibly philosophy, it wasn't as big of a surprise as maybe the sports books would lead you to believe.
Yeah. So they didn't, and also Greg Roman is going to be the offensive coordinator there. Right. Joe Alt really ought to help with whatever they want to build in terms of a Ravens-esque run game to support one of the things that's funny about this is I'm not sure Roman can build that same kind of running back with Herbert at quarterback. I think that actually will be very difficult for him.
Right. I completely agree. And they didn't really address the running back position until very late. They ended up with a guy that I did like, Kamani Vidal, if I remember correctly, running back out of Troy. And then other than that, we know that, you know, they are trying to be the Baltimore Ravens, but out west. So we call them the Ravens West with Gus Edwards and J.K. Dobbins running it back with Greg Roman. So we'll see what happens with that, but certainly not going to be as easy. They don't have quite the same, not even close to the same benefit of a quarterback mobile running threat that they did with Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I don't see them all of a sudden converting to a huge number of mesh plays or RPOs or whatever. They'll have some, but not a huge number, I wouldn't think, to really support the run game. So the Jets ended up picking Fashanu at number 11, as I mentioned. Then, of course, the double hit from in the division with Mims going to the Bengals and the Steelers taking Fatano at number 20. Both just crushing blows in terms of what could happen. Now, we expected both those teams might take offensive linemen, so it's not really surprising. The Bengals are now on quite a run of taking enormous tackles.
Yeah, they literally have 3 6-foot-8 offensive tackles on their roster right now, and all three of them could have starting spots this year. So they have a big offensive line. I'm not sure that it fits in what most teams are doing, playing more of the space zone scheme game, but perhaps Cincinnati wants to go more in the power gap scheme direction with the enormous size that they have.
It definitely seems like that kind of size, particularly if you don't go to the zone, but maybe even if you go to zone running also is going to really be able to lean on their opponents. Just the more you can do that straight ahead, I think the more you can get them tired by the fourth quarter. And I have a much greater fear of Cincinnati's run game now, but we'll see. So, okay. Now we're getting down into the nitty gritty here. We're in the 21 plus range, and there's still a couple of offensive tackles left, with the main one being Tyler Guyton of Oklahoma, who's actually played some left tackle. And he slipped and slipped. We thought Dallas might get him at 24. Dallas traded back to 29. We thought that Green Bay may take him at 25. Didn't happen. We get all the way to 29. We're still crossing our fingers that Tyler Guyton might drop to the Ravens at number 30. We also thought you got Kingsley Suamataia there, who might not be a terrible consolation prize, very high upside guy, at least from my perspective. As it turns out, Dallas, of course, disappoints us tremendously by selecting who they did. We've actually thought, I think you and I both thought that the Chiefs might take a tackle at 28 when they moved up, and then they ended up taking James Worthy.
Xavier Worthy, but yes.
The sixth man, right? No.
I think you may have left out Vitano to Steelers, but everybody listening to this, I'm sure, was watching the draft and is well aware of the first round picks that came off the board. But absolutely, there was that run on offensive tackles, and it almost got to the point that the Ravens had one really solid option at 30, and Dallas clutched him up right before us at 29.
Yeah, so Guyton is a guy, a lot of the guys in Latham and Mims, both SEC studs at Alabama, Georgia, respectively, haven't played on the left side yet. They're projected left tackles at the NFL level, and Latham certainly would not have gone as high as he did were that not the case. I think he goes 7 overall or something to the Titans, which was really early.
Yes.
I think the same of Mims. Mims is enormous. You could look at it more as a stochastic play for Mims. You're getting a roll of the die or whatever, and 1-4, he's going to work out at left tackle, and a 5 or 6 is going to be a great right tackle. You can think about it that way. But I think that it's really more both those guys probably will get their chance at left tackle, I would expect. The fact that Guyton had already played left tackle, even though he's very unpolished and he certainly is not perfect in any way in his time at Oklahoma, was a big positive. And one that I think a lot of people said maybe the Ravens should have traded up for. Obviously the team who had 28 and traded, and that was Buffalo, who traded it to the Chiefs, was willing to move.
Right.
Why not give that a shot? And, in terms of what it would have taken, about 40 JJ points to move up, which would have been about a pick in the fourth round, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds right to me. Honestly, because it was getting down to just one tackle at the end there, I viewed some of the corner prospects perhaps as higher value than Guyton, but the bigger need was certainly on the offensive line, so I wasn't overly disappointed that the Ravens were able to get a corner that they highly valued in Nate Wiggins at 30, but missing out on the tackle run was definitely a tough pill to swallow. And Guyton, certainly similar to Amarius Mims, has some tools that would lead you to believe he has the chance to make it at left tackle.
So anyway, we have to get over this Guyton thing at some point, and the Ravens are up on the clock at number 30. They had Kingsley Suamataia, who I think a lot of the people on the pod were calling for, but there was definitely call on the pod for Wiggins on the watch party for Wiggins as well. And my explanation of this was Wiggins is distinctly the better player. And you go back, you listen to me if you want this. Wiggins is distinctly the better player than Suamataia, but the problem is barriers to entry. And at left tackle has enormous barriers to entry. You just don't know when you're ever going to get a shot for one. It was interesting, I thought, that the Ravens in the press conference afterwards, DaCosta said if they didn't get a left tackle, didn't get a cornerback in round one, they thought they might not get a good cornerback. And then, of course, they go on and get a good cornerback much later on in the draft as well.
Sure. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I feel like they kind of lucked out in the fourth round with TJ Tampa, as we'll get to later, but I do understand what he was saying and kind of how, mock drafts and simulations work with certain positions. And corner is one over the years that if you don't get a guy early, the chances of you hitting on a player that can be utilized early in his career and be effective is very rare. Obviously, the Ravens got Brandon Stevens in the third round. And we believe that, he's turned the corner. He was a really good player last year. And that pick is looking pretty solid. But it's not like in his first year he was starting caliber outside corner. So, I didn't really have too many issues with the pick since the tackles really dried up at that point.
And I didn't either. I mean, honestly, for what it was, I'm okay with the pick. It's certainly a plus pick, a value pick. Wiggins actually is my number one corner on the board. And so it gives you an idea of how much I value the barriers to entry component, that I'm willing to pass up the number one corner for a player like Guyton, who clearly is unpolished and the sixth or seventh best left tackle in this draft. But Wiggins is a hell of a player. And let's talk about him for a second, I guess. He's the most athletic corner in the draft, not just in terms of speed, but in terms of his jumps, really good size in terms of height. There's a little bit short arms. This was pointed out, and 30 and a half inches. He's not like some of the slot corners you see that can be down in the 28s. There are players who are shorter than him. There are plenty of players who are over 31 and a half, 32 inches as well. So he's a little bit disadvantaged there. Fastest 40 time at the combine among all corners. And I want to get into his 2023 metrics as well, but anything else to say about Wiggins, the athlete?
He was the fastest corner in the draft. And honestly, the pick seemed to me like it was somewhat a response to what Kansas City did in the first round. You know, them taking speed and Xavier Worthy, the fastest combine player ever, and the Ravens taking a corner that ran in the 4.2s, it makes a good bit of sense. The Ravens clearly have probably the most difficult division in the AFC North, with every team being in contention for the playoffs this past year, with three of the four making it. And winning division should be first and foremost. However, Baltimore has to be able to get over Kansas City in the playoffs because they seem inevitable at this point. So building a roster with a larger AFC competition scope makes sense. And I think Wiggins is a good player for, going against Jamar Chase and his athleticism, as well as going against the likes of Miami with all their speed, and Kansas City. So I was a big fan of the player, and especially the athleticism that he brings. He can truly rely on his recovery speed, and I think he already has a decent amount of polish and technique, but there's plenty of room to grow with him being a young player and still being able to put on some muscle to his frame.
You know what's good about this, and you mentioned both technique and muscle as areas of potential growth there, and I think both are possible. He's only 20 right now. He'll be 21 in August, so that's fantastic news from that perspective. But I love it when a player like this already has outstanding coverage metrics despite some limitations. So he really killed it this last year in 23, 4.3 yards per target. And he had a 44.4 opposition passer rating. The 4.3 yards per target, I didn't have a ranking for that, but the 44.4 opposition passer rating was the 10th best among all corners. And there's 190 guys who had met a snap limitation I set for that. So I love it when coverage metrics corroborate outstanding physical gifts. I also love it when coverage metrics are there before every single technical and polish gift is already there. It's kind of like having a young hitter who already is hitting 300 with a lot of power and he's still striking out a ton. Well, that guy, when he strikes out a little bit less and he gets more batting average ball in play on more balls, that's really going to improve your situation. So Wiggins is a very nice addition there. During the 2023 season, Tez Walker beat him for a 43-yard play in the win over North Carolina. By the way, despite that, Wiggins had a really big game that day with interception and a forced fumble that we've talked about multiple times, one of two on the season that was very similar. But the second longest play he gave up the whole season was only 18 yards. So Tez Walker is a Raven, so maybe we can like what's going on with regard to that.
Yeah, absolutely. He looked really good. In what I've seen of Nate Wiggins, I was a big fan. He was strong in the North Carolina game, which probably was his toughest, you know, just in terms of that big play to Tez Walker, and then what he was able to do against Miami, as in Miami, Florida, and Virginia. I mean, he is just a stud player. Those aren't the best teams, and the ACC isn't necessarily the greatest conference, but I think he went against enough solid players that you can feel pretty confident with where he's going to be to start his career.
Yeah, I do completely agree with that, but you're totally showing your own Georgia stripes there, and that's fine. one thing that he'd been a little bit that'd been questioned about him was his tackling ability, and he's got a pretty damn good tackle rate. And since he wasn't targeted all that much, well, actually, he was targeted a moderate amount, which is a lot for a coverage corner as good as he is. The good news from that, by the way, is it's not a tiny number of targets that his 4.3 yards per target was derived over. If it were 10 targets or something, giving up 43 yards and nobody ever threw at him, well, I'd still say maybe we don't know everything. I mean, that's an unbelievable number, but maybe we still don't know everything. But in this case, they threw at him a bunch. They just weren't successful doing at it at all, and that's good news. So his tackling was a 13.3% missed tackle rate, which is about almost square on the median of cornerbacks, the 190 that I looked at. He was penalized just once the entire season. Now, that's a guy who knows he can rely on his recovery speed, as you mentioned early, because he will not get grabby when he gets a foot in the wrong direction at the top of the stem. He's thinking, I can catch out. No problem. I got this. So I like that. The final thing, I noticed he was 23 on the consensus mocks that I saw. I thought he was a top 15 talent. The other guys, everybody's got a little bit in terms of warts. Quinyon Mitchell, who was the first one off the board, I believe, has real context issues of where he was. Terrion Arnold, played in the SEC, didn't have quite the metrics that Wiggins had. So I thought Wiggins was the guy, and it did not play out that way for him. He's the third corner drafted, I believe. Yeah, the third corner, because there are two of them, McKinstry and DeJean, went to day two, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
But I did think it was going to be a fantasy that the Ravens would get him at number 30. Just absolutely thrilled that they got him, still concerned at the end of day one about where the Ravens left tackle situation was.
Completely agree with that. You want to move on to round two then?
Let's do it by all means. And so round two, we had a lot of trades at the beginning of the day, and we don't have to say too much about that other than than some of the cornerbacks who were left on the board got taken fairly quickly. Saw a trade at the end of the first round to get one of the guys I really wanted.
Yeah. So at the end of the first round, your guy for the second round was Xavier Leggett out of South Carolina. The Carolina Panthers moved from 33 to 32, I believe it's just that one spot with Buffalo to take him. And then another guy, Ricky Pearsall, went at 31 to the San Francisco 49ers. So we kind of got another small run on wide receivers at the end of the first round and into the second. And Ricky Pearsall was a big favorite of James Ogden. Once again, I'm going to continue to bring his name up because I just really like the work that he's done for his website, Red Star Baltimore. In his appearances on your pod as well as some others. So
we're very grateful to have him, and he does great work. And I recommend his draft guide to anybody. But he very clearly puts a lot of work into that. And it's something where, with a newborn or whatnot and an actual job and a life, I don't know how he does it. I mean, since my semi-retirement, I've had a hard time understanding how anybody with a real job can do this kind of stuff. So anyway.
Yeah. So, Xavier Leggett maybe went a little bit earlier than a lot of people were expecting, but his name was very hot. As we entered the draft on Thursday night. So a little surprising, but I think they got a good player and somebody that will certainly help out Bryce Young, as early as this year.
So we had a little bit of run on corners, a little lot of wide receivers off the board in round two, and they weren't necessarily in the order that I expected them, but Keon Coleman went at 33, Ladd McConkey at 34. Mm-hmm. Jalen Polk was a little bit out of order from my perspective at 37 to the Patriots, but hey, they're the Patriots. They probably know what they're doing. And then we had some corners run off the board as well, and Dejean, McKinstry, Lassiter, and Melton all four in a row beginning at 40.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Cooper Dejean was somebody we were talking about on the show for the Ravens, and that was a big surprise that he made it into the second round. I thought that Baltimore perhaps would have liked to have another player with some interchangeability skills that Kyle Hamilton already shows us in Baltimore. And clearly he just wasn't as high on the board. I think the Ravens prioritized pure outside corner coverage skills, and Cooper Dejean maybe fits more as a safety slash cover three corner, somebody that's really good in zone and maybe can do some of the things, you know, moving into the slot and whatnot. But the pure coverage skills of Nate Wiggins was just more enticing to EDC.
Yeah, and I would agree. I'm not – maybe the Ravens are really well suited to take advantage of Dejean's versatility, but since they already have a guy, a safety that they like to bring up, it might be more complex to get that done. So it's easier probably if Dejean is the queen of the chessboard probably for some other team than if he's here in Baltimore and they have to be concerned about him on every play when they also need to be concerned about Hamilton and where he's playing. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the interesting things about the second round is there weren't any offensive tackles taken between 29 and 55. So that was a long stretch through the desert. I know Patrick Paul had announced on Twitter before the draft they thought he was going in at the end of the first round, not in the second. His name still had not been called. And then a couple other guys, Blake Fisher and Roger Rosengarten and Kingsley Suamataia, those four tackles, kind of all consolation prize level tackles, were still on the board. Fisher is a guy, you know, watching Notre Dame play a fair amount that I thought would have probably been a third round pick. But we still saw some of the residual impact of the tackles taken in the first round hit again once Patrick Paul was taken off the board by Miami at pick 55.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Patrick Paul was another high upside player that has that ability to play left tackle. And Miami got to start the run in the second round on those tackles. And, you know, Blake Fisher went before Baltimore as well. Yeah, I feel like he's more of a true right tackle. I'm not sure how you feel about Fisher, but
yeah, Fisher more likely to stay on the right side. I would agree.
And then, you know, we got to the Ravens picking Roger Rosengarten. I mean, clearly, this was a one that we talked about on night two. I was involved with that, and a lot of us were kind of on the Kingsley train. Just felt maybe he had more upside and potential to be a left tackle. And Baltimore clearly felt otherwise. At least they felt that the better value was to take Roger Rosengarten, not necessarily that that he has stronger tools to be a left tackle, but you know, there's a lot of things that could go into it. They need help on the offensive line in 2024. Mm-hmm. To start with, and Roger might be more NFL ready day one than Kingsley Suamataia.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, by the way, that he's certainly more ready now. I one of the advantages the Ravens had is the fact that they have Ronnie Stanley signed for 2024. So they have the luxury in this draft, had the luxury in this draft of a ramp up year on a developmental left tackle, where a lot of teams don't have that. They cannot wait. And when you draft as low as the Ravens do year after year after year, you're not going to get one of the NFL ready off left tackles very often. So you got to take advantage of that ramp up period when you get it. And so that's where I felt a lot of the value was lost here. Rosengarten himself, a substantial overdraft relative to the mocks. And look, I hope, like every Ravens fan out there, Roger Rosengarten ends up being a great NFL player, but let's not pretend like he's there right now. He's got a lot of very significant shortcomings, even though he's got a pretty decent PFF pass blocking grade. I want to go through a little bit of what I saw in the national championship game with Michigan at some point during this. He only had, as PFF scores it, by the way, only 15 pressure events in 625 pass blocking snaps. But that included five in the national championship game. I looked at the national championship, every pass blocking snap he had in that game, I would say the number is either 10 or 11. Okay. And so I'm going to run through these plays and I'm going to lay them out and we're going to talk about who got them. Who got him for pressure, how they got him for pressure. You guys can watch the tape because I'm going to give you the pressures in the order they occurred. So you're going to know by uniform number and by how he got beaten, which ones I'm considering a pressure. All right?
Right.
And so if you disagree, that's fine. But I'm going to tell you the PFF is being very
generous
in terms of his invasion of the cone. So I'll just say that. So there was quite a lot of that. But let's talk about his specifics first. 6'5", 308, 33.5-inch arms, which it's a little bit short for offensive tackle, but there's been plenty of offensive tackles gotten away from it. That's not too short for the right side at all. It's just it's short on the left side. 4.92 40 would tell me he could get out there and be a very good run blocker once he's trained. Mm-hmm. So far has not graded out well as a run blocker in college. He does run the backside of some counter plays. But I would not say he's an exceptional displacement player so far. I wouldn't even say he's really been exceptional holding the back end of too many double teams. So it's been, you know, can he move up a half level and seal? Yeah, I can usually do that because linebackers will typically have shorter arms. That's a scraping player you're getting at that point. I am hopeful that Joe D can fix a lot of the run blocking elements. Where I'm less convinced is you got a very polished pass blocker here, very polished guy. He's got a great mirror. What he doesn't have is he doesn't have the length for two things. One is to make up for getting beat to the outside and really push a blocker 12-6. You can definitely see opponents are too effective using their length against him or using one arm longer than two a lot of the times. And the other thing he really doesn't have is the anchor. Mm-hmm. So he's a little bit lean at 6'5", 308. That's small for a tackle. And boy, look at the other guys in this draft at 6'8", 340 and, you know, right, all those. So there's a part of that. I want to give you a chance to respond to any of that stuff before I move on to the individual plays in this national championship game.
Yes, I agree with you. I do feel like he has a lot of potential due to his athleticism. His 4.9, what was it? 4.96, 40. Yeah. 4.92. That was the fastest out of all offensive linemen in this draft.
Really? I didn't know that. Yes. That's fantastic.
Yeah, the fastest at the combine for any offensive lineman. So that is very good. The Ravens clearly want to move to a more athletic line. I think we've seen that by some of the moves they have made. You know, drafting Tyler Linderbaum for one, somebody that can really get out and run and make some hay at the second level in the run game. And you know, he had his deficiencies, especially in his rookie season, as far as being a pass protector. But Joe D and whatever Tyler did in the offseason really helped solidify his work as a pass protector in his second season. So I do believe that Roger Rosengarten can learn some things, you know, with Joe, as far as becoming a more effective run blocker. And I do think one of his main deficiencies now is the lack of sand in the pants, as a lot of people like to call it. He just doesn't have a lot of weight in his lower half. And that is where sometimes he will lose his anchor against some of the more powerful bull rushers and, you know, the speed to power guys. So,
yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think in terms of the run blocking, I do think a lot of that's on Joe G to make him a better run blocker because he's big enough to block any level two guy. And the technique necessary to do the things at the line of scrimmage, we're never going to expect him to be a big displacement guy, but we will expect him to be a good guy to hold the back end of double teams or to climb well and get there. And he's got the speed otherwise and the tools and probably the processing from, you know, what we can see on interviews. of the guy.
Right.
Seems to be a smart guy. So I'm not really concerned about the run block. I'm concerned about the pass blocking. And I think more than anything, that element of positional improvement is all on the player. It's on him to go and get the off-season training he needs, because the team is not going to have time to work with him individually to make him better pass blocker. And there's two components to it. One is the physical, that he just needs to get bigger. Mm-hmm. He needs to add, you know, probably 15, 17 pounds by the time he really matures as a player. And he's still only 21, but by the time he really matures as a player, he needs to probably get up to about 325 pounds that he's carrying and have it be good weight. And also become a better hand fighter. Now, Phil Simms talks about this every once in a while, and people go in to get karate lessons, or they do other martial arts and whatnot to become better hand fighters, whatever it takes. You know, whether that's offensive line school, whether that's something else, he's got a long way to go. And the national championship game really gave me a look at that, because the guy he's playing, the guys are playing against, and if you look at the Michigan guys, for example, the year before, or what the 2 years before, when the Michigan team had Aiden Hutchinson and Ajabo, right? That was two years ago. Mm-hmm. That was an unbelievable group of pass rushers. The Michigan guys are actually a fairly pedestrian group that got him for a bunch of pressures in this game. And you know, he's in the Pac-12 before that, so I don't know where they fall in your estimation of Power Five conferences, but not at the top.
No, certainly not at the top. I will say that the Pac was impressive this year. And maybe it was just a couple teams, but it was kind of funny seeing, you know, their whole conference basically being dissolved in this upcoming season, and then finally, you know, putting together a really solid season with Oregon and USC, with Caleb Williams and, you know, Washington for sure. So, yeah.
Yeah. Two of the top, you know, two of the top quarterbacks anyway, going there. So
didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious, high-potency gummies, top-shelf flower, home-baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
At Ritual, we know what goes into the holiday season. The potluck planning, the gift giving, the spreadsheets. So this new year, take a moment for yourself with science-backed support that puts you first. So whether you're focusing on supporting foundational health with a clean vegan multivitamin or supporting your gut health with Symbiotic Plus, do it with 30% off your first month at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tap. Also, on them.
Service plan required for watch or tap. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm just going to go through the plays one at a time, but the guys, one of them I actually liked in the draft, the first one who got to him was Jalen Harrell, who ended up going in the seventh round. He has a reasonable chance to make the roster. And then Braden McGregor was a UDFA signed by the Jets. He got him once. Derek Moore, who is a pretty darn good pass rusher, probably the best of this group. He's in the 2025-2026 season, but he might be out in 2025, I think, from how well he played in 24. He did get beat by Chris Jenkins on a stunt once. I'm going to go through these in order so you can watch that cut up of that game and ask yourself, you know, is what I'm hearing about pass blocking really correct about this guy? And then the fourth was, did I mention Josiah Stewart?
You have not mentioned.
Okay. Yeah. He's the fourth. He's number five. So anyway, I'm just go by uniform number. He's beaten inside by 32 after oversetting to the outside. That was not a pressure. He was beaten outside by 8 by speed for a pressure. He was bulled on a stunt pickup by 94 for a pressure. Not unexpected, but he got bulled pretty badly. He gave ground to number 5. That's Josiah Stewart inside, rushing from wide 9, but the pressure came first from the other side. No pressure scored on that one. Tripped over the guard on a field stunt handoff. Probably not his fault. PFF may have scored it differently. I would call that not his fault and just give him a 0 on the play as opposed to a minus 2. He lost 17. That's Braden McGregor, again, inside for a pressure. The second half, by the way, is terrible of this game. Just utterly terrible. And Washington was catching, passing all the time in the second half. Beaten inside by a spin move by 32. Harrell, again, for a pressure. Gave ground to 5 on consecutive plays. I don't believe either of those was a pressure. Allowed a pressure to the stunting 5. Beaten outside by 32 speed to flush Penix, definitely pressure on that one. Beaten outside by 32 for pressure. Beaten outside by speed 32 for pressure. Turned around by spin 32 for pressure at the inside. And then bulled by 8, forcing Penix to throw off balance for one more. So it was a very tough second half in particular for Rosengarten. And you might, I don't really care whether you call it 9, 10, or 11 pressures. I don't think there's any way I can come up with 5 out of that, at least not the way I score invasion right of the cone and making sure the quarterback is comfortable with his feet there. I know PFF scores it different for me, but I'll give you a chance to watch the tape, see how you like it. Try not to watch individual plays. Try and watch the entire thing and write them down on a pad. But a guy who gives up a pressure every fifth play, and they did have about 56 pass blocking snaps in this game, is not a guy who's going to score very well, but the highest you could score is about a 40 if you were perfect on your other plays. And so, he did in fact give up. I don't think I have it in here, but he did have a quarterback hit on one of those plays as well that was surrendered. So very tough game. And let me say this also, it was his worst game of the year, but it wasn't superior competition. You know, Chris Jenkins is the only guy who's kind of a mid-round draft pick that even faced. Everybody else was 7, UDFA, not you know, anybody who's at the top of the list of pass rushers in this draft. Not anybody else that I'm aware of who's going to be a great NFL player, although who knows about Josiah Stewart or Derek Moore, who are coming out later. So it's right, possible one of those guys could be good. But Jalen Harrell was the main one who continuously beat him. And he's a guy that I don't think anybody's going to put at the top of NFL pass rushers. So anyway, enough of that.
Yeah. Something that you mentioned earlier in regards to what he needs to do is really get with some personal offensive line coaches. And in his interviews and, right after the draft, at least I learned, and probably some other people knew prior, he had been working with Joe Staley, the longtime San Francisco 49er offensive tackle, is going to be a Hall of Famer. So it is good that he has some connections like that, in that he has been working with a phenomenal former player. I'm not sure how much work Staley has done with other players in developing them, but it is good that Roger is already kind of taking that responsibility upon himself to improve, before he even gets to an NFL team.
Well, good for him. And the Ravens have had a number of tackles they've drafted late who have either worked out a tackle or worked out somewhere else on the inside. Ryan Jensen was a tackle who became a center later. In the case of Rosengarten, I don't think there's another position for him other than tackle. If he can't play tackle, he's I guess he could move to center would be the most likely. He's just totally not the right body type for guard.
I agree. I don't know that he'll ever put on the weight or really change his shape to become a guard. Yeah. That's just something he doesn't appear to be. in, you know, what we wanted is more of a tackle early in the draft, and we got that. So hopefully he develops and is able to stick at one of the tackle spots, and it would be fantastic if he had the tools to become the successor to Ronnie Stanley on the left side. But as of right now, I would be pretty surprised if that is the case.
Yeah. All right. Outstanding. So maybe still needs to be fixed. Hopefully a player who will help immediately in 24, because the Ravens are very shorthanded on the offensive line, but not a true developmental player in the same way that Suamataia would have been, where you're probably going to have to redshirt him for a season and mm-hmm. hope he doesn't play while you improve technical aspects of his game and coach him up to his size and length.
Right. In the one little caveat that I would add, Roger had played left tackle prior to the final 2 years at Washington. So I don't know if he has any college snaps necessarily at left tackle, which would be the valuable thing, right? But in his high school, and I think just before he got his starting opportunity, he was a left tackle, and they moved him to the right side to be the blind side protector for Michael Penix, which, you know, that is a positive thing. In some ways, Washington, you know, could be saying, hey, this is a very refined pass protector, and we want to put him on the blind side for Penix. Or it's just, hey, we got this other guy, Troy Fitano, that is a really good left tackle. Let's keep him on the left side and just move Roger over. So
let me just address that before we move on. First of all, great that he's on the blind side in terms of that. I think mirror is really critical to have on the blind side. So I guess I could see a time when he could move to left tackle. But if I'm comparing him to Ronnie Stanley, the first thing that comes to mind is that Ronnie Stanley gives up a lot of bump pressure on the backside mm-hmm. because he makes that exchange of mirror for space. And he's very good at it. And Jackson is very comfortable with it on that side. And so the same could happen to Rosengarten as well, as being a guy who gives ground for space. I think one of the big differences between the two is in arm length. And mm-hmm. you got about an inch of arm length different there. And it makes all the difference in terms of getting the good grip inside on the player, and then even having your grip strength come to bear at that point. So you really need you need to be able to get in there, jab, get to the inside, or even to the armpit, to be able to get your grip strength to then be a factor on the play. And a lot of the longer arm guys, that's what you'll see, is the rep is over as soon as they get latched on. They're like, I don't know, giant squid or something latching right. on to the opponent. He definitely has some problems with not being able to, even though he's got a mirror allowing a pass rusher to roll off him in one direction or the other. And I think a lot of that is length related. It may also be in part hand fighting related. And that would have to be the area in which he can improve, because he's not going to improve his length at this point.
Yeah, completely agree. With that, I think we've really kind of touched on Rosengarten. Do you want to move on to the third round?
Absolutely. So give me your thoughts on Adisa Isaac, who came out in, yeah, I guess he was in round three, right?
Yeah. Adisa Isaac out of Penn State. He is the more productive pass rusher out of the duo coming out in this draft from Penn State between him and Chop Robinson. A player that I saw was very effective on stunts. A lot of times he would even go untouched, which doesn't necessarily give you the best idea for his ability to beat blockers at the next level, but it was nice to see his effectiveness there. You know, something that lots of scouts and analysts comment on is his ability to beat up tight ends. You know, and that is obviously a good thing. You don't want a pass rusher that can't do that. So it's a positive there. And I think he, even though he was the more refined pass rusher, he still offers a decent amount of developmental tools for Chuck Smith to, you know, fine tune. So I'm pretty excited with what he brings to this outside linebacker room. I could see him having a similar role to Tavius Robinson in terms of snaps this year, but perhaps a little bit more. It just depends on the health you know, David Ajabo, if he gets mixed in there or not. And I do think Adisa Isaac has more pass rush potential than what we got out of Tavius last year, where I think Robinson is more of your edge setter. I think Isaac can do some of that, but he's going to be more of a designated pass rusher until he kind of develops.
Yeah, I first of all completely agree with that in terms of him being a designated a situational pass rusher, a guy they bring in on second and long, third and 10, late in games when they want pass rush. And they could do a lot of rotation certainly with that. The Ravens have already got kind of Malik Harrison and Robinson to take early down, usually base defense snaps on the edge. And they stuck with that pretty much for all of 2023. It wouldn't surprise me if they start 24 that way. Then they might need Malik to remake his body yet again, to lose a little bit of weight, frankly, because he was playing, I think, at around 259 this last year. That was his listed weight anyway, to go back to playing inside linebacker. Now, they don't absolutely need it to start the season, which makes it difficult and a really hard chore for Malik to play at the right weight. But his early playing time probably comes at outside linebacker in base packages. Later on in the season, though, if anything were to happen to Roquan Smith, they're going to really need a two-down thumper in there. They could go to the street to get it because they've done it certainly with Josh Bynes before, but I think it could be Malik's. So anyway, in terms of how that affects the total snaps there, Malik Harrison didn't have a lot of snaps, but somebody's got to play those snaps. And so I think they want to keep all of their situational guys, which really means Owe, Ajabo. Owe is a two-way player, but Ajabo, it probably still means Van Noy. They don't really want to make a run defense guy. And I'm sure it means Isaac just because of his size. So it means a lot of snaps on first down for Robinson. And maybe he's paired up with Owe sometimes. Maybe he's paired up with Harrison other times, but they don't have a lot of space right now. I mean, I was thinking they'd go out and they'd find another vet who would be a guy. I think the reason that will happen, and it might happen close to the season, is because somebody gets hurt. Either Isaac suffers an early camp or off-season injury or whatever, and he can't start the season, or Jabo's not ready, or Jabo gets hurt again. I don't think we're quite at the point yet. I don't know how you feel about this, that Ajabo might not make the team, it being year three.
Yeah, I'm not at that point yet. I think we've seen some flashes from him, albeit very small amounts, just due to the amount of time that he's been on the field at the NFL level. But it would be a really tough look for the Ravens to move on from a high investment second round pick in his third season. You know, certainly possible, and you know, it's a sunk cost at this point. But I would not love it if they moved on, and then you know maybe he figures it out somewhere else, and then you know you just get caught with your tail between your legs.
There's risk in all directions in life. Take either fork in the road. There's risk, and if you keep him on the roster, he underperforms, and you didn't take the opportunity to get the guy you should have. That's a potential loss too. Really sad that the gamble wasn't made easier for them to make, because no one would blame them. No one would think it was the wrong move if he was just entering his second year after an unproductive rookie season after an NFI season.
Right, exactly.
But now we're not there anymore, and that's a shame. But let's go back and talk about Isaac, because we didn't talk about too much of him before. In terms of measurables, he's a little bit light in the loafers at 247, but he's 6'4", got long arms. He'll be 23 in October, and he runs a 4.74 40. Those are all really nice characteristics to have. We're a little spoiled here in Baltimore because we have a sub 4.4 outside linebacker in Owe. Isaac, it represents, you know, well above average speed at that outside linebacker position.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's one thing when you're coming from probably one of the most freaky athletic testing universities in Penn State, with just the amount of athletes. I'm sure it started before Micah Parsons and Adafe Owe, but you just think about those guys recently. Chop Robinson was pretty darn athletic this year as well. Yeah. So, you know, him being compared to those guys makes him look unathletic, but that's not the case. He has plenty of juice. Running 4.7 is perfectly fine for an outside linebacker, and You know, you think about the days where, you know, the Ravens were getting sucks because of his poor athletic testing. I think he ran in like 4.8 something, 40-yard dash. I could be wrong there, but, you know.
Yeah, he asked the question, when do I ever need to run 40 yards to get the quarterback kind of thing?
Yeah. I think he had a decent 10-yard split, but it worked out for Baltimore, and I think he has plenty of athletic tools. So Baltimore is certainly blessed with the edge rushers that they do have and that potential. When you consider Owe Ojabo, what Kyle Van Noy was able to do last year coming off of his couch. Yep. And Isaac, of course, and Tavius as well.
We really have to hope they realize some of that this year. Probably need to get something out of Isaac as a rookie. I won't say definitely because there's going to be some game day inactives. Ojabo, Robinson, Isaac, any of them are possible inactives on game day. So we'll see how that works out. But they've got kind of a 6-to-make-5 situation there. Won't be Harrison. Harrison's needed on special teams. So, you know, they certainly have him active. A couple things about Isaac I want to make sure. Pressure rate in his final year is 15.9%. I thought in the run game, he's not terrible. He's just too small to deal with a pulling guard. He's not really great against tackles that are bigger than him. It'll be kind of fun to watch. Even with some brother-in-law play, you usually have some players who are trying a little bit harder, and Isaac and Rosengarten will probably be among those both. I'm sure they'll be up against each other a lot during camp, and that'll be something I'll be looking for. Isaac had non-obvious Sam characteristics, but he did drop 11.7% of the time in college. So maybe I look at the 40 time, maybe that's something. And he had solid results. That's 6.5 yards per target. So it wasn't like tight ends were burning him consistently for big yardage. But that's a nice trait to have, by the way, so you can drop the coverage and give your pass rush the flexibility to send somebody else, slot, inside linebacker, or safety on the pass rush. So that's nice. I have one other thing to say about Isaac, and it may be unfair as a criticism, but I think there's a lot of throwing to the outside in the college game from various teams, including some bad ones. Mm-hmm. And he's only had one batted pass in his whole college career, and that was way back in 2019, 4 years ago. So the reason I don't like that isn't because he should be jumping up at the line of scrimmage to knock down a pass. You get some that way, and you know if you're Dunlap, you get 5 per year or whatever. But the other place we get a lot of them is in screen pass diagnosis. And so when the screen goes to the outside, you should have a player who understands what's going on, realizes, oh, a screen pass, and immediately bolts to a spot where he has a chance to deflect that football. And the fact that he's only got one minor criticism, but there were probably quite a few screen passes that went off on his watch to his side where he didn't make a play on the ball.
Yeah, I agree with that. It reminds me of the stat you mentioned last year with Will Anderson out of Alabama and his lack of forced fumbles.
Yep.
You know, with all of those sacks that he was able to accrue, how did he just have one forced fumble in his career? You know, one of those kind of head scratchers, but I think it's working out for the Texans so far. And hopefully that's the case with Isaac, where, you know, get him around. You know, maybe Kyle Van Noy is probably the best Ravens outside linebacker at diagnosing and getting hands on footballs probably right now. And then, you know, talk about the defensive line as a whole. You got Broderick Washington that's been known to get his hand on a football. And, of course, Brent Urban. So, you know, I think some other people can influence him. And Zach Orr is going to be chomping at the bit to get these guys disruptive.
Yeah, and that is one of the real nice things about Isaac is he's a guy who they certifiably got some first pressures by adding him. So he's a guy who will get to the quarterback first, move the quarterback off the spot, create opportunities for players like Matabike and Pierce and Owe to finish Van Noy, whoever it is who's rushing the quarterback. Clowney's job last year, in a lot of ways, he did pick up a fair number of sacks, but he picked up a ton of pressures, and those really helped Matabike in terms of his sack total. Urban as well got two cheap ones against San Francisco off initial pressures by Clowney. So, you know, it's just he created a lot more sacks than his own sack total would tell you. Let's move on to round four here on day three. And the Ravens had 6 picks. Exciting day coming up. And we won't talk too much about the general flow of things, other than to say I think we really noticed a large divergence from consensus that was occurring on day three. A lot of people way over drafting. I thought in division that McKinley Jackson, is it the guy, the inside guy that was drafted by the Bengals? I think he was a third round pick, and I probably had him as a fifth round pick. And let me see who that was here. I think that's the guy.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I don't recall.
Yeah, McKinley Jackson, the defensive lineman from Texas A&M, 159 consensus, and the I think it was in the third round, but it might have been early in the fourth that the Bengals got him. So a fairly significant overdraft in the name of need. And whenever you see that, you know the Ravens are probably going to benefit from who they end up getting. And their first pick of the day at number 113, which were still, 13th pick of the day at this point, was Devontaze Walker, a wide receiver who'd been largely spurned early on during this process. A lot of wide receivers are off the board at this point.
Right. Leading up to the draft, the months prior, I believe Tez Walker was probably in the top 15 wide receivers for most people that are talking about the wide receiver class. Mm-hmm. I think Steve Smith Sr. and, not everybody has to necessarily give credence to his evaluations of players, because who knows to the level that he's watching these players, but he has those little clips out there that you can find on Twitter/X, and where he's talking about guys. And Ted Walker was somebody that he is pretty high on, but he had outside of his top 25. So I don't really understand how he's high on somebody, later there. But he had mentioned Tez Walker has a ton of tools, his ability to win deep down the field. He believes that there's a lot of room for growth, and you get this guy in a receiving room with good receiving coaches and get him to lock in. And he thinks, in year two, he's going to take off and really become somebody. So, that's a little encouraging to hear. I know that Steve Smith was, high on Zay Flowers last year. And, he was a great player for Baltimore in the short stint that he had here. But, my own personal viewpoint on him, a player that offers X wide receiver ability on certain routes, but does not have the full route tree. And that's something that he's going to have to work on in the off seasons. Right now, His skill set certainly opens up the deep passing game for Lamar Jackson, gives a target, and hopefully pushes back the safety coverage. And that can do a ton for the team. They added Derrick Henry. The run game is still going to be a big part of what Baltimore does. And if there is a legitimate threat of passes going over the head of the defense, that's a good thing for both the running game as well as the intermediate passing game. So I think he early in his career, I don't want him to be a one trick pony, but maybe two, three routes that he's really confident in that the Ravens can utilize him and make him an effective piece of game plans. And I really think that's kind of his early role. And perhaps that will take some of the weight away from players like Rashad Bateman that for whatever reason struggled with the deep ball connection with Lamar last year.
Yeah. I mean, I still think that needs to be fixed no matter what, even if Tez Walker's on the field at the same time, whatever it might be. I mean, okay. A lot to unpack there, but we'll start with the route tree. You're 100% correct. And he's got to even start with a good two route threat there. And particularly if you're on the X side of the field, you're out in space. I mean, your route running is supposed to beat the corner opposite you, who is often the best corner the other team has to offer. And you need to be able to fool him and be able to run multiple routes. And Devontaze Walker is more of a, you would hope that he would be a deep threat. And he is that. He's a good contested catch player, but also a guy to come back for the football and be effective. And surprisingly, not good on hitch routes. 5.2 yards per target on hitch routes. Part of the problem with that is he's a terrible yak receiver, which is unacceptable for who he is. I mean, he's a big man at 6'2", 193. He's got long arms, 33 and a quarter, 436 speed. That's part of forcing missed tackles is to make people miss in the open field with your speed. He's a track star in terms of his jumps. I mean, you know, should be all sorts of things that should make him very dangerous in the open field. And he's got 2.8 yak per reception in his final year there at North Carolina. Two missed tackles forced in 41 receptions. So that's just completely unacceptable for a player of his size and athleticism. And also, it's not like he has a bad quarterback who's forcing him into bad situations all of the time, like the ball's high and outside, low and away all the time. The catcher's always having to dive for it. Well, that's going to make it hard to get stolen base or caught stealing. But in this case, the ball's right down the middle a lot from Drake May, and he still was not doing a lot with it after the catch. So most of his success was on a fairly limited number of vertical routes where he had tremendous number of yards and a good completion percentage on those, which I really like that because I think Lamar will have a high degree of trust in him because of his size and some of the success he's had already in throwing them deep ball. And it won't be that relationship like he had with Bateman where he seemed to be overthrowing him on the deep ball a lot. He'll really trust him to go get the ball like OBJ. At least I hope that's the way that develops. But right now, I don't see him as a backup X, not right away. I do see him as a backup X, but I don't see him as the X receiver right away who's going to take a bunch of snaps away from Bateman because he just doesn't have the entire schematic diagram, that entire set of routes you could do to do various things against various coverages and really take advantage of that defender on that side of the field. So he probably starts on the strong side of the field have some opportunities to run out of bunch routes and other thing, develop those hitches at a better level, maybe pick up one or two additional routes as you're saying, whether they're deep crossing routes. He does do some of that now, by the way, likes to kind of go to the middle of the field. The thing that will help him most will be become a valuable extended play target for Lamar. Lamar will trust him to a much greater degree if he can show he's that. The thing that will hurt him the most if he becomes a problem with his hands that starts causing interceptions. Bateman had that, unfortunately, right off the bat in his career, and that did it. It's taken him time to regain the trust of Lamar. So we have to hope that doesn't happen to Walker in the same way.
Yeah. Oh, I can go ahead.
I'm looking.
I completely agree about all of those things. You know, thinking more about the player. I don't want to rub people the wrong way when I say this. He, in some ways, he reminds me of Devin Duvernay. But I will say there are some major differences. Devin Duvernay coming out of college was more of a screen receiver. Mm-hmm. He did catch the ball downfield here and there, and he was very strong hands. Continued throughout most of his career in Baltimore as, you know, really sure hands. I think Tez Walker has fairly good hands, not as good as Duvernay, bobbles the ball a little bit, but is good in the contested catch game. But the area that I find them to be similar is that they're both linear athletes. And when you were talking about the yak ability, that kind of resonated the point. Tez Walker, for whatever reason, and I have seen a decent amount of him now, just doesn't seem to have a bunch of wiggle to his lower half. He, for whatever reason, he has that pure athleticism, that speed. I'm not sure that he's ever going to become a real yak player. And I hope I'm wrong there. And obviously he can prove me wrong and anybody. But I don't really see it in his movement skills that he would become a severely better yards after the catch threat. However, what he does have is a good skill in, you know, getting vertical, catching the deep ball. And the area that he can definitely improve is driving back to the football on your hitches, your curls, your comebacks. And I think that is an area that showed up negatively on film, in 2023 at North Carolina. So I think there's plenty of meat on the bone for him to improve. He hasn't had a great situation yet in his career, you know, moving around places. I believe he has an interesting story, growing up as well. And he's faced a ton of adversity already. The linear athlete that has the speed but doesn't have the wiggle seems like not necessarily the yards after the catch player that many want.
Well, hopefully that is something that'll improve. One thing is if you can develop a slant that's deadly or potentially deadly after the catch, then the other thing that'll give you is a sluggo. I mean, right. you kind of automatically gain that if you can threaten the slant and the slant is deadly because of the kind of speed you have. And Devontae's Walker is faster than Devin Duvernay. So it's just really hard to do because Devin Duvernay was a hell of a fast player, but we'll see how they use him in this first year. I would say I don't see them using as a gadget player, even though he's one of the fastest guys on the team. I think, and this is unfortunate because I think Zay is the better receiver and the more sudden athlete who'll get you better separation a lot of the time. I think Zay Flowers could be drawn back into more of that role. I'm hoping that's not the case. I hope they leave it with Hill and Ali and I guess those are the main guys, right, at this point. I'm trying to think of who else they've got who has a real speed.
I would agree that those are the two primary players, but what we saw briefly from Bateman last year on an end around ended up being a positive play. What I did see from Tez Walker in a number of games was also that ability to run end arounds, not necessarily huge gains, but he can certainly do it and get you 7 yards, with more potential than that. So I wouldn't limit it to just a couple players, but I certainly, like you, don't want Zay Flowers to be kind of pigeonholed into that role, because I think the more that you can get him down the field and winning intermediate, it is going to be great for Lamar. It's going to be great for Zay in the offense as a whole, because so much of the early portion of 2023 was Zay Flowers, catching screen passes and, having little gadgety things to do.
And then they finally started to use him on more of that, and they had a lot of success in using him deep. Last thing about Tez Walker is that he's really going to have to learn how to run block. And it's not that he's done none of it at the college level. He just hasn't been exceptional, and that's something he's going to really have to be with the Ravens, given how they want to use the offense. I don't care that Henry has a great head of steam or other backs we have are good missed tackles force guys. You got to be able to be a wide receiver who keeps his feet and is a good positional blocker. And frankly, at his size and his athleticism, and his length shouldn't be a problem at all for him. I'm sure if he decides it's not something he really is enthusiastic about doing, he's going to see the field less because of it.
Yeah, agreed. I don't believe that will be a problem. I believe he does have a good head on his shoulders. He has the frame. He has the speed to be a phenomenal down the field blocker for these speeding running backs that we do have, and Ali that does certainly have some explosiveness, especially after I was able to watch some more of him. A really good player in 2021, and has some of that Keaton Mitchell to him, less so where he can be tracked down, but he's going to break some runs and is also a more physical back coming out of college. So I'm excited for Ali, and Justice Hill still has great speed at his age, as a veteran in the league now.
All right. We're going to come back and talk about the last five Ravens draft picks on the second part of this show. Just so much fun talking with you about this, Jake. Really appreciate all the time you spent on the draft watch party, and hope people try and excuse me.
It was a lot of fun being part of the draft party. I was with you and a number of panelists on it, as well as co-host Voss on day two, and then Gabe Fergie and Nikhil Mehta and Kevin Ostreicher. There's even more guys that I'm probably forgetting, but all of the Ravens content people we have, you know, through Twitter and on podcasts are fantastic to work with and interact with, honestly. And I don't currently do any specific podcasts other than, you know, the occasional appearance here with you. But I thoroughly enjoy it every time that I do.
You're at Real Jake Vogel on Twitter.
Yes.
And you also cover a lot of Georgia football. Do you write any of that up, or are you just a fan who on Twitter who really shows stuff?
Yeah, I don't do any writing currently, but yeah, you can find me on Twitter and have conversations with me about Georgia, about Ravens, NFL, and college in general.
All right. Well, really appreciate you taking the time. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, the great offseason is in front of us here. We got a lot of free time. There will be a few more shows looking back at the draft here. And then we're going to start looking forward to this year with a lot of two-player episodes. If you would like to be on one of those and take a particular pairing of players, tell me about that. If you'd like to talk about a player from the past, I'd love to talk about you. Those short episodes, 15 minutes, nothing like this draft recap, but we'll do it very quick. Just have about three memories of the player you want to talk about that were special for whatever reason to you. Jake, thanks again for coming on.
Yep, thank you, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.